This is Notes from a Native Daughter. I am Soldanela. My guest today is the one, the only, the beautiful and amazing Luis Perego Moreno, a.k.a. Tio Luis, a friend, a colleague, and a fighter for artists, I think. He's an advocate, and he and I are kindred spirits in many ways, so we're going to talk a lot today. Thank you, Luis, for being with me in this hour.
Soldanela, I feel like we're home, and I'm sitting on your couch, and I've always connected with you. I've always admired you. I love your energy and what you champion, and I find you a kindred spirit. So thank you.
You're welcome. So, God, there's so many things that we can talk about that, you know, I think we'll have to do this in parts. But I want to start off, why don't you talk about what you just did with the Puerto Rican Heritage Film Festival?
So I'm very clear, and it was the opening night, which, you know, ironically happened to be the day after Election Day 2016, the presidential election.
Yes, so that's why I didn't make it, because I was so depressed I couldn't get out of my bed. I'm sorry. I purchased ticket and everything.
You and many others were, but I also felt that, I didn't realize till August what the dates really meant in the universe of the scheme of things. Mm-hmm. And then I just thought, you know what? Irrespective of the outcome, we're going to need as a community to get together. We're either going to need to celebrate or commiserate. And of course, my assumption was we were going to be celebrating and assumed that Trump was never going to get there. But anyway, we were together, and it was, you know, it was great. It was a great film festival. It was the sixth one. But what got me into this, you know, wave with you is, my disclaimer is, I'm very clear. It was the International Puerto Rican Heritage Film Festival. I was the official programmer. Mm-hmm. But that I'm Cuban Argentine. However, I add without the however, but raised within the Puerto Rican community of the South Bronx. Mm-hmm. So that I feel very Puerto Rican and found it legitimate that I could hold that position and gave my all to make sure that this was going to be phenomenal in many respects, that it was also going to shepherd Puerto Ricans from the mainland and Puerto Ricans from this country, as well as, and when I say country, is the assumption is because we're in New York and because there was such a great migration of Puerto Ricans in New York, that when one visualizes Puerto Ricans in the United States, and heaven knows it's changing now when we're seeing a large migration of Puerto Ricans to Florida, that we think just New York City. And that's why a segment of the conference was devoted to the story of Puerto Ricans in Hartford, Connecticut, which Hartford is not only 50% Latino, but it's 40% of its entire population is Puerto Rican. So it would be remiss of us when telling the Puerto Rican story in the United States to not include areas like Chicago, Philadelphia, but something that we don't often think about, which was Hartford. And that made me very proud, and that our opening night film was from Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. You know, that our closed night film was by a New Yorican, you know, so that they were beautiful bookends. Watching two documentaries last night on PBS on the 1920s and 30s through gangsters. There was a proliferation of gangsters in the United States from New York to Chicago, Al Capone, Bonnie and Clyde, and all of that. Mm-hmm. But what also came out in that, you know, in the 20s was the high-rolling 20s and then the crash of 29 and a very depressed early 30s, that in the 1930s we saw such a renaissance of the art scene in the United States, but especially a film. Mm-hmm. So as we're now entering a dour time for many of us in the arts community who are progressive leaning in the anticipation of the Trump administration, that I'm seeing the glass is half full, not half empty. And that I think we're going to see a great proliferation of artistic expression, especially everything from stemming against the administration and their policies, but also as a means of escapism. Here's where I'm coming from. For instance, this week, HBO aired two documentaries on Cuba and the Cuban experience. And one of the documentaries was not done by a Cuban, by not even a Latino. And the second one was done by a Cuban first-time film director, but the executive producer was Julian Schnabel. So when I look at stuff like that, and I also see, and some of the key executives involved in it are not Cuban, as someone through Prime Latino Media, which is all about supporting Latino multimedia makers, actors, and musicians, it would be duplicitous of me to say, I'm not happy with the fact that our story, and I'm not even going to go to the Buena Vista Social Club, that was not spearheaded by a Cuban, telling our musical history and story that I think we often get miffed, and rightfully so, when our stories are not told by us. When we're not seated at the table, you know, and there was stuff that I found offensive as a Cuban American, that, you know, were they realities of Cuba? Absolutely. But they were certain realities. And why must we always only show those particular realities? So if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. And I got to be careful of that double-edged sword. So if I have a right to be miffed, to be pissed that we weren't included in that process, I had to be sensitive to the fact and very humble of, I'm not Puerto Rican, and I'm programming a Puerto Rican Heritage Film Festival. However, I was raised in the Puerto Rican community, and it's not just that they were my neighbors. This was my family. These were the people who raised me. You know, my father was abandoned. You know, my mother was abandoned by my father, my Argentine father, when, you know, when she was 6 months pregnant with me. And it was a Puerto Rican family who took us into their home, you know, who became my godparents. And then after I was born, it was a Puerto Rican household I lived in, you know, who took care of me day and night, la abuela, who became my abuela. So I was immersed in the Puerto Rican culture and feel very proud and say I wouldn't be the person who I am today. I'm proud to say that I'm Cuban, genetically Argentine, but I wouldn't be half the person I am today if it had not been for the Puerto Rican culture.
That's so beautiful. It nurtured you. Well, I mean, to your argument about not being at the table, I think it's two different sets of, I guess, either concerns or grievances. I don't think it's so clean cut the way. When I see the landscape and who is telling the Latino stories, I think that we ourselves could be doing such a much better job at it, you know, than what we are getting, or what at least what we're seeing out there, definitely on mainstream, but even also on our own mainstream, you know what I'm saying?
But here is what I have been championing and fighting for the last 25 years. That there's this preponderance that oftentimes our stories are told by others. That I have heard as early back, not even as far back, as early back as 2004, there are no talented Latino producers. So when I'm looking at a project like that, you know, and so, and there was a project I was involved with telling our story of Cuban Americans in Miami, and here I am, a Cuban American from New York, but okay, at least I get the Cuban culture. But when, you know, the producer, because I lacked at that time the star power name, they brought in someone from another culture because they said there were no talented Latino producers or Cuban producers who could have been in that capacity, and they put somebody else who had star power. And, you know, so first of all, our industry, you know, the same way what I'm getting at, why is the Puerto Rican film industry so rich now? Because they've been investing in it for 10, 20 years. That's why they're at the level now. And if we don't invest in our people in this community, we're not going to get there. And you know what? In the last 20, 25 years, we have come around. So right now, for any of these projects, had you told me, do you have a Cuban director? I would say to you, I have an Academy Award-nominated Cuban director. I have Cuban directors who've done American Masterpiece for PBS. You know, I have stellar producers. These are people with proven track records. So no longer can you say to me, we're not there. So, yes, I should be able to tell a Quebecois story in Canada without being French-Canadian. But if there aren't some lead people with me sitting at that table there, shame on the project, because then it's not authentic about our community. It's others telling our story. And it's about time that we're part of that, not like this mafia that bars others from coming in. But if anything, I think we need to form a mafia to make sure that we do break that glass ceiling.
Mm-hmm. I see. Mm-hmm. But still, it's not just that. You know, there's a lot. There are a lot of other players and a lot of other interesting platforms where we ourselves could be telling our stories, for example. Right. You know what I'm saying? That is one part of the conversation. I don't think it's the conversation. That's all I'm saying.
I hear you. I'm just raising.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, what is it? It hurts and it's painful.
Mm-hmm.
When our stories from another perspective, you know, as simple as, excuse me, my abuelita would never wear an outfit like that. Why are you dressing her like that? Just something, a simple nuance like that. Not to speak of, you know, in a story of 10 people where everyone doesn't succeed in the USA, because this, you know, it's not a guarantee that all immigrants come here to succeed. But then why is it that you point out that some of the ones that didn't succeed were Latina women who entered prostitution and drug addiction? You know, it hurts because my mother was not a prostitute nor a drug addict,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it doesn't reflect most of our stories. And yet everyone who comes here, when they were framing it, this was a story about immigrants who come here, particularly Latinos, and not everyone succeeds, but some do. That there's different ways of telling that story, but you end the documentary focusing on Latinas who went the route in the U.S. as immigrants, as prostitutes and drug addicts. And frankly, from character actors to documentary makers, we say we're tired of those stories because they're not accurate, nor are they authentic. And if we were at the table, you know, they want a success story, I'd be pointing to a Soldanela.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's here. I know her. I know of them. So don't tell me that either as a story subject matter or as a producer behind the scenes that we don't have extraordinarily qualified people with proven track records
mm-hmm.
who can jump in there. And I understand, as you mentioned, you know, a lot of these people work with the same people for 10, 20 years. You know, budgets can run from $1 million to $4 to $5 million. You're not going to trust that to just anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But we have people who are qualified to handle that in 2016 going into 2017.
Sure.
Maybe 30 years ago we didn't, but we damn do now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We had them 30, 40, 50 years ago as well. But it's definitely a new time. And
as I did a documentary, Latina Confessions, What Does It Mean to Be Latina in the United States? When I interviewed... I did several clusters. I did a group in New York. I did a group in California that also included New Mexico, the Texas and stuff like that. And when they were asked, what does it mean to you to be Latina in the United States? They all responded. Now, when I went to Miami and I interviewed Cubans, again, these are my brethren, and asked, what does it mean to you to be Latina in the United States? Oftentimes, the response was, I'm not Latina, I'm Cuban.
Hmm.
So I'm wondering, oh my God, so why do I feel so comfortable with Latino, which again, I prefer Latino than Hispanic, because to me, Hispanic means you are of Spanish extraction from Spain, and all of us are not from Latin America. So that's why I get Latino. But because I'm not just solely Cuban, because I am Cuban, Argentine, and Puerto Rican, You know, what am I going to say? I'm Cuban, Argentine, Puerto Rican. It's much easier for me to say I'm Latino. And because I have those three diaspora within my being, I can relate to an Ecuadorian. Mm-hmm. I can relate to a Dominican. I can relate to Mexicans, Colombians, Paraguayos, because I have a little bit of all of that. And I can appreciate Latin American Jewish culture. I can appreciate when a Latin American of African extraction is not present at the table, when I have white privilege. And so when stories are told, I want to take into consideration, are all these groups and subgroups present at the table when we dare to say, this is a Latino voice? Because, you know, I'm a Latino, gay, Cuban, Argentine, Puerto Rican. So I've got so many flavors. I mean, it's like going to Baskin Robbins and can I have 10 of the 31 flavors?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It has made me more sensitive to mm-hmm. when I did Latina Confessions and took it to a college, and a Black Latina, Afro Latina, said, thank you for including us. And why did you? And I said, because as a Latino gay man, I know what it is to be omitted from projects when they say this is the Latino experience and I don't see myself there. Mm-hmm. So then who am I to leave people out? And I always try to make sure when telling the Latino story by Latinos born in the U.S. and by Latin Americans, are all our voices there and are we all represented? Because oftentimes worse than being misrepresented is being omitted.
Right. Well, actually, that could be argued, you know, just to play devil's advocate. It might be better to be omitted than to be misrepresented. You know what I'm saying? I'd rather not play the hooker and not be present at all, kind of thing.
Right. No, I hear you. But then, you know, but my thing is, I'm going back to what offended me in seeing those documentaries on Monday night was the misrepresentation. It, at the end of the day, it's, oh, he's such an activist, you know, and oh my God, it, you know, the pushing the Latino button. No. What's it registering with me? A very innate and basic human feeling of hurt and pain.
Yeah.
Of seeing that the only picture depicted of my people on the island, which is going through severe economic times, you still have people risking their lives to do that 90-mile trek across choppy, shark-infested waters who would rather die than continue living there. So there is a horrendous reality to Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? There happen to be loving people in loving families working hard to keep it going there. And so why is that whole hour just about misery? And again, when the image of Cuba today is prostitution. It's like we're back to the 1950s, you know, under Batista, before Fidel. So it's at the end of the day, I felt at the end of the evening depressed, because why weren't we called in?
Mm-hmm.
My having this network mm-hmm. of proven Latino multimedia makers, mm-hmm. and as a Cuban American, I was hurt that that's the story told to non-Cubans who, and the following day, just to show you, I got a text message because I spread the word out to mm-hmm. my Cuban mafia, mm-hmm. hey, this is going to be on TV. And again, a film, whether right or wrong, will always have two sides to it, will be interpreted two different ways. And a relative of mine, Cuban American in Miami, said, great, that was a great documentary, because it showed that Cuban utopia of this tropical, wonderful island is all a scam.
Mm.
And I'm like, yeah, because he and I share different politics.
Right.
And so he saw that as, yes, this is all that Cuba's about. And again, I'm Pollyanna. No matter where you are and no matter what you're going through, the glass, you have to look at it as being half full. You can't go through life that the glass is half empty. Because it's a miserable life. So, yes, Cuba's going through horrendous things. But there are still some wonderful things that define the Cuban spirit that I treasure and I'm proud to be part of. And that did not come out in the film.
I hear you.
At all.
I got that. I get it. I really do. I felt a little bit like that with the Latino version of the Latin explosion that HBO did, that was produced by Tommy Mottola.
Don't get me going. Another one. You know, we weren't involved in that.
It was, there were some really good parts that I totally was cracking up. But overall, it was, I'm not really sure, you know, how that continues to happen at that level, especially nowadays.
Because we're not brought in. Because, you know...
No, I think there's enough players out there at this point for many people to know who is out there.
We're not being tapped. We're not being
tapped. Right, yeah, yeah. We're not being tapped. And that's what I'm saying in terms of why, you know, why do they keep going around in circles? That's an interesting question. We're not the only ones, you know, that's happening to Asian Americans. That's happening to... less and less so to the African American community, but it's happening to Native Americans. It's happening to, you know what I'm saying? Like it's a melee that's larger than one specific sector, I want to say. And so we are left with these, you know, feelings of discontent, you know, just feeling so dissatisfied. Again, and I want to be very specific, this is not the entirety of the conversation. This is one aspect of the conversation, one for one particular a realm of consumption, which is the mainstream area in terms of television, music, radio waves, or even, you know, online viewing. 'Cause then there's the alternative... Then there's all these other movements of which, you know, many of these people and players, they're creating and are doing great things, like what you did with the festival, for example, you know, and all the other people and all the other people that you showcase through Prime Latino Media, you know.
But again, where you would have been an exceptional consultant because you come from a strong Puerto Rican musical background and you've been now in this country. Correct me. Over a decade, two, 3 decades? How long have you been in this country?
Almost 3 decades, 27 years.
Okay. So what was also lacking, yes, you and I know what's happening contemporaneously. What I'm also talking, they missed a sense of history. I mean, there was a Boston Globe reporter who reviewed that film and cited there were key characters missing from the 1980s when you're telling... You know, explosion experience. So again, unless you're of a certain age or your specialty is scholarly or, recreationally within a vast period of time, you know, you can't just be this drop-by voyeur who wants to do a project and feels that you can tell a story thoroughly. And that's why I say that productions don't have to be dominated by us, but we need to be present at the table so we give it authenticity, so that we lend an authentic voice, so that when you're seeing something about us, it's also by us and it's also for us. Because if we're part of the machine, you know, we're also consuming it. Mm-hmm. You know, the next issue is, you know, do we as Latinos support Latino projects? That's a big bone of contention of mine where we don't often do it, where I played films, at the film festival, and there were 1 to 3 people in a theater of 300. You know, Ari Manuel Cruz's Antes que Cante el Gallo packed the house with 300 people. Luna Velez with Adrift packed the theater. But there were other films showcasing Puerto Ricans from the mainland, you know, and 20, 25 people in a theater of 300 or 1 to 3 people in a theater of 300. You know, I've gone to film festivals. There's 5 people in the audience for a film from Latin America, or I've gone to theatrical productions that I thought were excellent. And in their 1 week run, they have to cancel their Sunday show because no one shows up to the theater in Queens for a Spanish language play. So it's like, you know, we fight for our people, we champion the cause, but at the end of the day, you know, if we don't support our own projects, I mean, this is, Puerto Ricans are still the largest Latino ethnic group in the city. If we can't throw a decent international Puerto Rican and Heritage Film Festival that is supported by the community, that, what is it, 500,000 people go to the Puerto Rican Day Parade once a year on Fifth Avenue?
Mm-hmm.
And I can't get a couple of hundred people who want to see the films in a city that no longer has a New York International Latino Film Festival for 4 years, then the state of things are pretty abysmal. And we can say we need to educate our people and stuff like that, but, you know, come on, mi gente. You know, these films will also only get done. I mean, in this country, it's all about marketing. How many eyeballs did a project get? And they're not going to commission another project if they say, we did it. You know, when we go in there, the power brokers representing the large group, and we say, where's our stuff? Why are we not getting more out there? And they'll say, but we screened something, and we got very few eyeballs. So we did it once. We put money into it, but no one came. So, again, that has to also be taken into consideration, because I hear them, and that's a worse enemy than there are no talented Latino directors, producers, camera people, and script writers. There are, but if they produce and tell our stories with an authentic voice, and we, the community, don't go and support them, you know, we need to beg the question, why after 13 years is there not an international New York Latino Film Festival? You know, so and there it's yin and yang behind the scenes and in front of the, you know, in, sitting in the audience. You know, there blame goes to all sides. But we as a community, you know, we can't whine and complain that our stories are not being told if we don't support them in English and Spanish once they're being put out there.
I see. It's a really interesting a subject to take on. And again, I'm what I bring on to it is more like a, there's another side of it. While what you're saying, what you're saying in many respects is true, I also see that there have been a lot of strides and a lot has changed. And certainly, you know, one thing to consider in terms of the overall landscape for viewership in terms of not only film, but live performances, whether it's dance or music. There's a lot going on right now. So that the reality is that there's a lot of fractured and competition out there that is reshaping how audiences engage with product. So that I wouldn't just necessarily outright say people are not supporting Latino content. Maybe we haven't explored different combinations, how to pair things together. Will, you know, one theater house serve all the films that we're presenting in the case of a film festival? Are 10 days necessary? Would it be better to have 2 days or 3 days in, you know, in relation to the week that you pick, the week where you're playing, the theaters that you have? You know, there's a lot of nuanced things that I think as we tighten and as the projects begin to happen can, in fact, you know, surprise us with sort of, you know, engagement. And I think, and I'm seeing that more and more, you know. And the truth is that audiences now have a lot to think about, you know, in terms of you have the internet and you have the games and you have the TV and you have the films and you have the showings. And it must be said that also, you know, the film industry as a whole is also shifting, and the way that audiences are consuming the film itself is shifting. So it's not just a, you know, I think it's more nuanced than that. Like, I think it's an interesting discussion to have, to see what are we doing the same, what has kept at, you know, at the same rate, and what can be shifted within the structures that stand, and that we still know they work.
But here's what I've also noticed over the years, and you've been to these same theaters, what we call the art houses, the IFC Center, mm-hmm. what used to be the Quad Cinema, Landmark, mm-hmm. Film Forum, Cinema Village, that these same Latin American films will play there, mm-hmm. and they will be seen. But who's in the audience? And again, I was born in a ghetto. I don't operate in a ghetto and don't want to be limited to a ghetto. And everyone should be able to see Latino projects. Mm-hmm. However, the preponderance of the audience that goes to the Angelica and all these art house theaters in southern Manhattan happen to be mostly white, college-educated folk with higher discretionary income who appreciate and embrace this. And you look around the audience, and you also go to other film festivals, and we're not seated in the audience, you know? And I have to admit, I mean, never in my childhood did my mother ever take me to a Spanish-language film. Mm-hmm. That's not part of our culture here. So it's not like, let's bring a, you know, the four centers of Latin American cinema right now are Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, and Colombia. Mexico has great stuff in it. But when a Mexican film plays here in Manhattan, it's not a preponderance of Mexicans seeing it. The Mexican community is not coming in from Queens to see it. And there really aren't theaters per se to sustain that in Queens and the other boroughs. So it's frustrating, but again, the glass is half full. Again, why is it also gaining speed in Puerto Rico? Because it's burgeoning throughout Latin America, and Puerto Rico lacks some of the technology. Like color correction is not something that can be done on the island, so they've got to leave the island to do it. And some of these other countries have that equipment and quality. But there's a rich community of artists who are producing. And when Ari Maniel Cruz premiered Antes que Cante el Gallo in New York, it had its U.S. and Canadian premiere at our film festival, the International Puerto Rican Heritage Film Festival, where it deserved to be at. But because it was in its 10th week in theaters in Puerto Rico, you know, and years, I think decades before, that was an issue. You know, it wasn't being sustained by the local community. So before it can be exported and succeed well out of its territory, it's got to be supported at home.
I see. Okay. We'll continue to discuss it. Definitely. I think it's turning, and I'm glad that you continue to talk about it and defend it and remind people about this issue and how to bridge together, you know, new audiences and the audiences and the work that's being created. It's definitely a subject for, like, even a course, you know.
Absolutely. It's definitely a study. But again, what mm-hmm. connects you and me is we love our culture. We love our language. So we can pick up something that is a quality and that was made with passion, and we can appreciate it. So we first, before we can promote something, we gotta like what we promote.
Yeah.
And I think you and I, because of the backgrounds that shaped us, you greatly musically, me by the diverse cultures that touched my soul, that we can pick up something and assess it in a different way and then show it to the world and say, this is wonderful. You want to check this out. You're going to enjoy this too. And that, because I'm at a stage in life after 70 documentary shorts and a few documentary features, that I don't want to make stuff anymore per se. I want to curate other people's works. I want to find wonderful jewels out there and people making great, wonderful jewels. and expose it to the world, expose it to our community and beyond our community.
Hmm.
That's what I want to spend my life doing for the rest of my life. You know, eventually down the line, ideally, what do I want to do? I want to executive produce projects. I've already done the legwork, the grunt work. I'm not doing that anymore. I'm not interested. But what I want to do is help someone who has a proven track record, who has a great idea, but lacks the resources. And by virtue of picking up the phone and making a phone call, or literally pulling out the money and saying, my money is where my mouth is. I love what you're doing. I want to see you realize it, that I want to help people, in especially in our community, realize their projects of passion that have an authentic voice.
Mm, that's beautiful. That's so beautiful. I think that's a great ending. I do. I mean, that's what it's about. It gives, all of this gives you purpose. And it gets you up in the morning, and that is what, you know, we hold on tough days, and that is enough. You know what I'm saying? That carries enough beauty and dignity and force to carry you through. That's blessing. That's bounty.
And, you know, in closing, eso alimenta el alma.
Seguro.
You know, that's what nourishes the soul.
Yeah.
Me personally, and I'm a great believer that everybody's got to get their soul nourished. And if I can find, if my epitaph on my grave can be, he had a talent for talent, mm-hmm. that would make me happy. And as I said, picking something up of quality with an authentic voice and demonstrating it to the world and getting them to buy into it and to be swept over by the passion, then I've made my difference. And that's what life is about.
Beautiful. Thank you. Te quiero.
Te adoro. Te adoro. Thank you, mi hermana de alma. And thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. We continue. We will carry on this conversation at a later time.
Beso y abrazo. Take care.